fulfill my ambition,
yeah.
which I didn't, because my ambition was to become a ballerina, but nobody ever heard of me, did you?
Oh.
but that was it. You know, I was able to study ballet and dance and theatre arts as well.
Dare I ask, has dancing carried on through the years? You still...
No.
Right. So you're not going to pirouette
only in
for
my
us.
Kitchen. Yeah. I still do my pirouettes and work out in the kitchen, but
oh,
nobody's watching.
Yeah. Can I ask, as you were growing up, was church a part of life for you or your family at all?
Yes, it was. It was very much part of our life. And I think in those days, we were never given any alternative to believing in God. And I think everybody believed in God. We went to church. We were told to behave. Mm. And so that continued right through my life, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
But at that stage, how did that feel to you? Did it feel a real thing? What was it like?
It was as real as they could make it in those days. It was more or less a finger-wagging God. This is how I was brought up, telling me that if I didn't behave, I'd go to hell. And if I was very, very good, I'd get to heaven. And that was sort of explained to me. But it was one of those things that I think it had an effect on me, because I never felt that I matched up to what God was expecting of me. And I didn't get the reality of it till a lot later.
Okay. Well, we might come back to that if we may.
Absolutely.
But can we come back to the dancing? So you'd had this wonderful training. Did you go into the world of dance? What happened?
I did, yes. I didn't, as I said, I didn't get into a ballet company. I wasn't good enough for that. The next best thing in those days, if you didn't get into a ballet company, was to get into the chorus of pantomimes and Summer Seasons.
Ah.
And I don't know if any of you remember Summer Seasons, but they were variety shows that functioned all around the coast of Great Britain in the summer.
Yeah.
And so I started off in that way.
Great.
The school actually enabled me to do some auditions when I was still at school, so I was able to go into a pantomime when I was at school, came back after the pantomime, did a summer season, then came back. And then I left school going into a pantomime at the Coventry Hippodrome. And I made a decision at that time that if I didn't get good enough to get a solo part within a year of starting show business, I would give up and, as my father said, get a proper job. But fortunately for me, I did get a
solo. I was going to ask,
part,
did
I?
Yeah.
So I didn't
yeah.
have to get a proper job.
Oh, great.
And actually, we were trying to mess about with that quiz. And I said, now you realise why I didn't get any A levels. I didn't even try.
Yeah. Oh, great. That's lovely. Can I ask you a little bit about your life with Roy?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of time in your life did you meet, the two of you?
We met when I was 22, and I was in a show that you'll all you'll all know about, because it was The Sound of Music, original cast of The Sound of Music.
And go on, which part did you have?
Well, I understudied and then took over the part of Liesl, you know?
Oh, yeah?
I am 16, going on 93.
Yeah. They're joining. They're joining,
Have a sing-song instead. Yes, so I was in that show in London at the time.
Yeah.
But it was all to do with Eric Morecambe.
Oh, go on, tell us.
Tell us.
Yes, go on.
Well, I was at the Coventry Hippodrome.
Mm.
Harry Secombe was top of the bill.
Yeah.
Do you remember Harry?
Yeah.
Yes, he was lovely. He was best man at our wedding, actually, because he was Roy's best friend.
Right, yeah.
And Morecambe and Wise were second on the bill.
Yeah.
And, of course, you all remember Morecambe and Wise. And I got to know Eric and Joan, his wife, very well at that time. And then I did another show up in Morecambe, actually, with Morecambe and Wise and other people. And I got to know Eric and Joan really well. So they used to invite me to their home at weekends occasionally.
Mm.
And they were really good to me because they knew I was a starving dancer. And so they used to fill me up over the weekend and give me all the leftovers to take back to my little garret flat for the rest of the week so I wouldn't starve.
Lovely, yeah.
That's how lovely they were.
Yeah.
And it was just during one of those weekends that we were sitting down watching television and Roy happened to come on the television.
Yeah.
And he just made a name for himself. And I'd seen him at the London Palladium and thought he was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
So in a very stupid moment, I said to Eric, oh, if ever you do a show with Roy Castle, can I come along? Because I'd love to meet him. I think he's absolutely brilliant. Oh, all right, love, was all I got. And I thought, that's not going to happen.
No.
And it didn't happen. I mean, I got on with my career and forgot all about it, really. And then suddenly, Eric phoned me. He was at the Palladium and I was at the Palace Theatre in The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
And Eric phoned and said, hey, Fiona, I'm doing a show with Roy on Sunday. Do you want to come along? Oh, yes, please.
Yeah.
So I went along with Joan and went to see the show. And just before the show started, Eric took me into Roy's dressing room to introduce me. And I was so excited. I thought this was going to be the best moment of my life. And it turned out to be the worst.
Go on.
Typical of Eric, because he just took me into the dressing room and said, Roy, this is Fiona, she's in love with you, and then left.
Can I ask, was that in keeping with the way he was?
It was absolutely in keeping with
him.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't mind what he said to anybody, whether it was the Queen or a dustman, you know. But the lovely thing about him was that you didn't take offence because there was no offence intended.
But how did you react being left in that room?
I stood there blushing up to the roots of my then blonde hair, wishing I could die. I was so shy. And Roy was actually very shy, so we just looked at each other. There was nothing to say after that. And then I left, and we went to watch the show. But it all went a bit better later, because Roy invited all the cast, all the people who'd been in his show, to go out for a meal, and he included me, so that was rather nice.
Lovely.
But what I didn't find out until Roy knew me well enough to tell me was what Eric had said to him that evening before we'd met. He said, look, Roy, I've got this rather sad case coming to see you. Could you be nice to her? She is a bit of a case because she's got braces on her teeth and pigtails. But if you could be nice to her, I'd be grateful.
That's marvellous.
Typical of Eric.
Yeah. But obviously something did. There was obviously a bit of a click because you ended up getting married.
Yes, we married exactly a year later.
Oh, lovely. And where did you start off life together? Where did you...
Well, I gave up my career. I was still in The Sound of Music up until about a week before, a couple of weeks before we got married.
Yeah.
I gave that up because Roy was working a lot in the United States at that particular time.
Yeah.
He was doing really well with television and working in Las Vegas and places like that. And I thought, well, if he's over there and I'm stuck in London, there's not much point us bothering to get married.
Yeah.
So I was very happy to go and be with him because I was going to places I'd only ever read about and seen on maps, you know. It was fantastic.
Yeah, exciting. I guess many of us, those of us here, will have memories of Roy's great show on TV, Record Breakers. Just for those who perhaps are slightly younger than that generation, what was Record Breakers?
Well, it was all to do with the Guinness Book of Records, which why the quiz had such
Absolutely.
Low marks. But it was the McWhirter twins who started off this idea of doing a show for children about all the Guinness Book of Records.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. They did it as an experiment, thinking it would only last one season. It actually lasted 22 years.
Wow.
Which was amazing, wasn't it?
And they made quite a thing of breaking records on the show, didn't they?
Yes.
That was part of it. Yes. Which obviously involved Roy in one or two things.
It did,
Any particular ones stick in your mind, things that he had to go at records breaking?
He said the most terrifying one was he had to do the death slide from the top of Blackpool Tower down to the beach, which was a third of a mile.
Oof.
And he was just on a piece of rope.
Yeah.
The rope was sort of in a figure of eight, and he put his hand through it. The rope had to be soaked in water for 24 hours before, otherwise it would have burnt through before he got down to the bottom.
Oof.
And he said just getting over the top of Blackpool Tower and going to nothing was very frightening.
Yeah.
But I think the one that I was most worried about was he had to parascend under all the bridges of the Thames. And I was terrified that they wouldn't slow the boat down enough and he'd be decapitated under one of the bridges. But he said it was much more dangerous to go under the water and drink the water of the Thames. He thought he'd die that way.
I suppose you had to get used to being quite brave at times.
He was, and it was the way the producer asked him to do these things, you know, because it would have made him seem like he was pathetic if he didn't bother.
Right.
So he stood up to all of them.
Yes.
He had to wing walk across from Gatwick to Le Bourget on an aeroplane, on the top of an aeroplane.
Throughout the flight?
Throughout the flight,
on the wings?
Stood on the top.
Goodness.
And that was a bit scary as well.
Yeah. Goodness me. He also, my recollection is that he did have a record to do with a number of instruments.
Yes.
What was that about, the things that he played? Because he was a musician, wasn't he?
He was a musician, yes. He had to play 43 instruments in 4 minutes, playing the same tune.
Wow,
I mean, one of them was the kitchen sink.
Sorry, how do you play a kitchen sink, Fiona?
He just put a mouthpiece into the tube, into the sink,
right,
and played.
Fabulous. Because he played the trumpet, didn't he?
Played trumpet, all the wind
and
instruments and guitar and drums. And he had an alpenhorn, which was about 9 foot long.
Oh, one of the,
yes. And I think the worst experience I had was when he learnt the bagpipes.
You better tell us, how did that go?
Well, I was preparing Sunday lunch and I was peeling the potatoes at the sink, and suddenly I heard this terrible noise coming from the sitting room. I can only describe it as a cow in labour. It was sort of So I went rushing into the sitting room to see what was going on, and there he was trying to play the bagpipes. He was teaching himself the bagpipes.
Oh my goodness.
Did
he succeed?
Yes. It was all right in the end, but it wasn't a very nice noise.
No.
But he was self-taught completely. He never had one music lesson.
Wow. He must have had naturally a very good ear.
I think he did, yes.
Brilliant.
Very, very good.
Yeah.
He had to go into the RAF for doing his national service. And coming from Huddersfield, of course, everybody played in brass bands there, didn't they?
Yeah.
And his uncle and his grandfather were very involved with the band. Yeah. And when he went to do his national service, his uncle gave him a trumpet and said, "There you are, lad, you might as well do something useful whilst you're in the RAF." And Roy taught himself to play the trumpet.
Goodness,
whilst he was in the RAF, drove everybody in the billet mad. But they never complained, because Roy had also been trained to be a barber. So he used to cut their hair for free, which saved them one and threepence or something going down to the barbers.
Goodness, brilliant. So just thinking to your life in those days, Roy was doing record breakers. You say he had shows in the States as well. It's a bit of the celebrity lifestyle. What did it feel like for you?
It never felt like a celebrity lifestyle.
Mm.
I think in those days, we just got on with the job.
Right.
You know, Roy was simply thrilled that he could earn a living doing something he really loved.
Yeah.
And that was the bottom line.
Yeah.
There
was
no celebrity status in him whatsoever.
Yeah.
And he was so down to earth.
Brilliant.
He used to call himself as an ordinary down to earth little Yorkshireman. And he was right on all of those counts, because he wasn't very tall.
So things were going really well for him. I think for you, they weren't quite so easy, were they, Fiona?
I went through a very difficult stage.
Mm.
I had four children, and when we had children, we made a decision that when they had to go to school, I would always be at home to be the anchor for them, and Roy would have to travel when he had to and come back when he could. And at that particular time, he was away most of the time.
Yeah.
I didn't mind that at all. I loved being a housewife. I loved being a mum. And so from that point of view, it was fine for me.
Yeah.
My problem was that I was a perfectionist. I don't know if anybody suffers from that dreaded disease.
Right.
The trouble with being a perfectionist is that you never match up to your own expectation of what that perfection should be.
Yeah.
And I was always struggling, striving to be this perfect wife, mother, homemaker, hostess, whatever it took.
Mm.
And I never felt that I was good enough.
Mm.
And I think something that I've probably come to understand since then is that we tend to look at other people and see their strengths.
Yeah.
And we look back at ourselves and see our weaknesses.
Yeah.
And that was something that I was always doing.
Yeah.
I would look around at my friends and they would be doing the things I was trying to do, but doing it far better and with far greater ease than I was doing. However hard I tried, I didn't match up. No. You know, I'd be flying around picking one child up from school at one school, and then if that child was late, then the next one would be late for ballet or football or whatever it was, and I'd be in a state. And there'd be mothers standing at the school gate looking at it as if they'd just stepped out of Vogue, not a hair out of place, everything perfect. Why couldn't I have been calm and nice and lovely and like that? Or, you know, or when we had people to dinner, when I went to other people's homes, everything got cooked at the right time. Yeah. They came to me and that didn't happen, even however hard I tried. Yeah. Yeah. So I always felt like a failure, and, and my self-esteem was completely rock bottom.
While all that was happening, do you think Roy was aware how things were
he
for
was
you?
Aware, and he was wonderful. He was always trying to encourage me.
Yeah.
He was a great encourager. His standards were not high. He was just happy, you know.
Yeah.
And he loved being with people, and it wasn't the quality of the food that I dished up that was important. It was the happiness within the framework of it was much more important to him. So he did try, but I always came back to this place of failure.
What did that sense of failure start doing for you, though, Fiona? How did it...
How did it make me feel?
Yeah.
Well, suicidal.
Really?
I didn't get that far, and I never would have done because of the children, but that's how I was feeling. I just felt, I'm rubbish.
Yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah. Now, I think I'm right in saying about 1975, things came to a bit of a head. Do you want to just tell us a bit about that?
On the 25th of February 1975, I just felt one morning after I'd taken the children to school, I'd had enough. I didn't know where to turn, what to do.
Yeah.
I went up to my bedroom, got down on my knees, and I just cried out to God. And I said, God, if you're there, you've got to help me, and you've got to help me now, because I've had it. I cannot go on like this any longer. Mm. And that's all I said. And I don't honestly think I expected God to even hear me, let alone do anything about it.
No.
Even if he was there at that stage, I was wondering if it was all a load of rubbish.
I was going to ask about that. Had church carried on being part of your life?
It had. It was very much part of our lives. I'd insisted that Roy got confirmed before we got married. Mm. And we had the children christened. We went to church every Sunday. Again, trying to tick the boxes because of this finger-wagging God.
Yeah.
And Roy, I have to confess this, but Roy used to say to me, I don't know why you bother to go to church. He said, by the time you get the children in the car and ready to go, you're in such a foul mood, it can't possibly do you any good. But as I would go through the church door, good morning, everybody. What a delightful day it is today.
Yeah.
You know,
so there's a mask one can
put. A mask with a smile on, but inside I was falling apart.
Yeah. So, I think you said 23rd of February 1975. Tell us what happened that day.
I hadn't even got up off my knees after that very brief prayer before the phone rang. When I answered the phone, the person who was at the other end was a woman I'd probably met a couple of times, would never have expected her to phone me for any reason whatsoever. We didn't seem to have anything in common. The only thing I did know about her was that she was a Christian. And she just said, Fiona, I don't know why I'm phoning you, but I've had you on my mind recently, and I had this sudden urge to ring you. She said, I feel as if you need to talk. Would you like to come over and have a coffee with me and talk? And I realized that that was God's amazing way of answering that desperate cry for help.
Yeah.
So I said, yes. I went round to her house then and there.
Yeah.
Couldn't wait. I dumped Benjamin, our baby, who was about a year old, into Roy's arms and said, I'm going out, left. And he told me much later that he thought I'd literally left him holding the baby and that was never coming back.
Goodness. So he knew you were not in a good place.
Yeah. He was probably quite glad about it as well because of the way I was behaving. But anyway, I went.
Yeah.
And I think because I didn't know this woman very well, I felt free to talk.
Yeah.
I would never have told a family member or a friend how I was feeling, because as I said, I would try to keep this mask up. But I just felt that I could offload on her because she didn't have any relationship with my family or with my friends. And so I dumped on her, and she was a wonderful listener, and she heard me out. And then she asked me the most challenging question anybody's ever asked me. She simply said, "You know, Fiona, you think you're a Christian because you go to church, but have you ever invited Jesus to come in and take over your life?" I said, "No, I hadn't. Didn't realize you were supposed to, as far as I was aware. That wasn't in the Book of Common Prayer, you know.
Right.
I hadn't read anything about that, you know. I just thought I had to be very, very good."
Yeah.
And so when I said I hadn't, she said, "Well, don't you think it's about time you did?" And so I just said yes, and I only said yes because I was afraid to say no. I didn't know what it would mean.
No.
You know, I thought it might mean, A, that I would have to try even harder to be good.
Goodness.
And then fail even more.
Yeah.
Or that I'd have to wear sandals and socks and put my hair up in a bun and never wear makeup again or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
That sort of reputation. But anyway, she told me that she had suffered from depression for many years and that taking that step had totally turned her life around and transformed it. And I thought, well, if it's worked for her, it could work for me. Tell you what, I would have tried anything that day if I felt that it would work. And she helped me to say a prayer that actually led me to the Lord and invited Jesus into my life. I was not very good at praying prayers apart from "God bless Mummy and Daddy," you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So she had to help me, but it was a very simple prayer. "Please, Jesus, forgive me for the mess I've made of my life up to now. I recognize the way I've tried to run my life hasn't worked. Mm. So you come in and take it over and see what you can do with the rest of it, okay?"
Mm.
And that was my okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I was expecting. As I said, I was still thinking that I might have to try even harder to earn God's favor.
Yeah.
But at that very moment, as I prayed that prayer, it was as if all the tension, anxiety, and fear that had lived with me most of my life just melted away. And in place of it came this incredible peace that I'd never experienced in my life.
Yeah.
And that peace has never left me.
Wonderful.
40 years on, it's still there.
Yeah.
And it's not dependent on circumstances. That's the best thing about it. It's a peace that's there no matter what. Even though, you know, as all of us do, we all go through turbulent times and difficult situations. Mm-hmm. But just knowing that Jesus is there with me, helping me to cope with whatever happens, is the best thing that could have ever happened to me.
Yeah. So presumably you went home.
Yes.
And how did that go down with Roy? Did he notice anything about you?
Well, I didn't tell him.
Oh, right.
Can you imagine if I'd gone home and said, "It's all right, darling, I've become a Christian. Everything will be fine." He'd have done a runner. She's got religious mania as well as everything else.
Yes, yes.
But God showed me very clearly on that journey home, which was only about a mile from my home, that I hadn't to tell Roy. I had to live out what I'd discovered by being different. Yeah. And that's what I did. And my circumstances didn't change. I still went home to the same family, the same situations. But it was my attitude to all of those things that changed, which was just amazing to me, that I could sort of analyze that and see it.
Yeah.
I think one of the most important things that happened to me as a result of that was to always make sure that there was a happy atmosphere in our home, no matter what.
Mm.
That there wouldn't be tension or anything, that there would be a real sense of peace and joy and laughter. Mm. Because I wanted my children to bring their friends home at any time of the day or night and know they'd always be welcome and they'd always have a happy time when they were with us. To me, that was the most important thing.
How did that affect all your kind of perfectionism and feeling you had to be the best and look good? And how was that?
I wasn't a perfectionist after that at all.
Right. So did Roy pick this up?
Roy picked this up very quickly, but he didn't ask me. He said that when I came home that day, it was as if somebody had painted our house in 2 seconds flat. I'd gone out and it was all black and gloomy, come back in and it was all light and bright and sunny. But he thought it might just be a 5-minute wonder, so he didn't ask.
Right.
So it took him a while.
Yeah.
And then he started to ask questions like, where did you go that day and who did you speak to and what's happened to you and why are you being nice to me? And so I was able to tell him what had happened. And he said, oh, thank goodness. He said, I've been praying for years that you'd see the light and become a reasonable human being again.
That's great.
So I think he had the right idea right from the start.
Yeah.
He said when that happened to me, he had to run at 100 miles an hour to catch up.
Right.
But he did, and his faith remained very simple all the way through.
Yeah, yeah. Do you mind me asking now a little bit about Roy's illness and obviously his death later? How did you find out he was unwell?
Well, it was interesting, actually, because Roy had insisted. He was working over in Australia.
Yeah.
And he'd insisted that I went, and by that time the children were old enough. And I'd always put it off, no, I'll stay home with the children. I'd never gone to any of these places with him. But he was very insistent, so I did. On the way, when he came home, I thought he was just suffering from jet lag.
Yeah.
And I teased him and said, poor old thing, you're getting too old to travel. You'll have to, stop worrying. But this got worse. And suddenly in the middle of the night, he thought he'd had a heart attack. He was desperately ill about 3 days after we got home. He was rushed into hospital, and they actually discovered that it was a very serious virus that had taken all the sodium from his blood.
Yeah.
And he was very poorly as a result. They then recognized that it was probably because his immune system had broken down that the lung cancer kicked in.
Right.
And that's how it happened, because the specialist, when he was examining Roy, said, are you a smoker? And I said, no, I've never smoked. Yeah. He said, are you telling the truth? He said, yes. He said, I've never smoked. But he said, I've worked in smoky theatres and nightclubs for many, many years, but I haven't smoked myself.
No.
And the specialist went very quiet, and he went, passive smoking, they're doing a lot of research into that in America. Yeah. And, of course, they hadn't done it over here.
It was still quite a new idea here. Yeah.
And he was giving Roy the sort of impression that it could be lung cancer.
Yeah.
But we still didn't believe it because he'd never smoked.
Yeah.
Anyway, he had to go to the specialist to get the diagnosis one evening. And a friend of his was at home waiting because this friend had made a video about a charity that he was running.
Yeah.
And he asked Roy if Roy would do the voiceover for it.
Okay.
So he turned up at the house, and I'm saying, I'm really sorry, Dave, Roy's a bit late coming back. And eventually Roy came back, came into the kitchen where we were, and he said, right, I'm really sorry that I'm so late, Dave, but I said, I've got some bad news for you. He said, I've got lung cancer. He said, it's the fastest growing kind of lung cancer. He said, without treatment, I've got 3 months to live. With treatment, I've got 6 months to live, and it's inoperable. Okay, Dave, let's get on with that voiceover. And off they went into the sitting room to do the voiceover. Left me standing in the kitchen, feeling as if I'd just turned to lead.
Mm.
I couldn't speak. I couldn't move. I was in so much shock.
Yeah.
Roy had taken it just like that.
Yeah.
And I just started to pray and say, God, what are you doing? What is happening here?
Yeah.
And it was almost as if I heard an audible voice in the room saying, stand back and see what I'm going to do through this. And suddenly I realized that God hadn't abandoned us. He still loved us. He knew what was happening. And furthermore, all he was asking of us was that we would allow him to work through the circumstances we found ourselves in at that time. And suddenly it all went back to normal. I thought, well, yes, we're in his hands.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, he's there with us and we don't need to be afraid.
Yeah. And then, of course, it must have had quite an impact for you, Bert, because presumably he went through treatment. And how was all that?
He was amazing with the treatment. Again, he didn't tell anybody what was happening. And he was about 2 weeks into treatment before the press found out about it.
What were they like? What was the press like?
Well, it was quite strange, really, because we'd always lived such boring lives that the press had always left us alone.
Yeah.
And they started to phone me in the middle of the night, one night. They were phoning me all the way through the night, all these different people from the press. So I just told them what had happened, and I thought, well, there'd be three lines at the bottom of the newspaper the next day, end of story.
Yeah.
I had to go out. I was actually working at our church the following morning, came back at lunchtime, and there was a row of cars down our street, which was very unusual. There was a row of reporters and photographers standing outside our back door.
Yeah.
So I said, what are you all doing standing outside? So one of them said, oh, well, Roy will only let us in five at a time. So I'm thinking, how many seats have we got in the sitting room?
Right. And he was kind of giving interviews five at a time.
Yeah.
Goodness.
And so I said, oh, well, come on into the kitchen and I'll make you all a cup of coffee whilst you're waiting, you see. Got into the kitchen and the sink was absolutely full of dirty coffee cups. So I realised that Roy had been entertaining them all morning.
Yes.
When the last ones left, Roy came into the kitchen and said, well, he said, I don't know what they're going to put in the papers tomorrow, but he said, I've told them all about Jesus. And I went, what? And he said, yes. He said, I've got a platform now. He said, if my faith hadn't been real, he said, if it had gone out the window with the cancer, but he said, it's more real than it's ever been.
Mm.
So he said, they've got to believe it.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it's a long way of answering your question, what the press were like. They were wonderful to us all the way through. They really were.
Yeah.
They were very, very loyal to Roy and very helpful. It was quite funny, though, the very first time when they were having to wait for Roy. We didn't find this out till the next day. We were going round our village into the shops, and the press had gone into all the shops trying to find out some scandal about us and what we were really
like. Right.
Yes. But we lived in that Gerard's course for so long that all the people in the shops were really nice about us.
Goodness, yeah.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Just shows how you have to behave.
Fiona, I have to ask, how long did he actually survive with the illness? How long was it?
2.5 years he lived.
Yeah.
And we saw that as a bonus. Mm. Every day was a bonus.
Mm.
Because Roy said, you know, we have to get on with our lives, but we must stop and smell the roses on the way. And that's what we did. We just enjoyed our time together, which was very precious.
Yeah. Fiona, I think I'm right in saying that's 23 years ago now.
It is, yes, coming up to 24.
As you look back on it now, how is it with you today?
I just rejoice. That sounds awful, doesn't it? God, the day Roy died, God filled me with so much joy. That doesn't mean happiness.
No.
That means
say a bit more about that, yes.
I was obviously, you know, tearful and very sad. I'd lost the person that I love most in the world. We had a wonderful relationship and, you know, a fantastic marriage. But all the time, even if I was weeping, it's like a well of joy bubbling up inside me, and it was irrepressible.
Yeah.
And Roy was wonderful. He said, you know, we must never grumble. We must always be thankful. We've had a wonderful marriage. We've had lovely life together. We have so much to be thankful for that we must never complain.
Mm.
And I followed that through afterwards. And it was wonderful, actually, how that happened.
I guess there'll be quite a number of folks here who know something of that experience of losing a dear loved one. What would you say have been the most helpful things for you over the years that have been most encouraging and comforting through that?
Since Roy's died, I think. Well, I don't want to express anything as a definite, because there's no blueprint for bereavement. Everybody goes about it in a different way. Everybody sees it in a different way, copes in a different way. And so I'd never give ideas. But for me, obviously, just knowing Jesus was the best thing that could have happened at that particular time.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I felt was so important was to get on and make the most of my life, not sit back and cry in a darkened room with curtains drawn. Because the longer we stay that way, the harder it becomes to get back into normal life.
Yeah.
God did that for me without me wanting it or thinking or even thinking about it.
Right.
In the most amazing way, because the day after Roy died, the person who was the chief fundraiser for the charity that Roy was involved with before he died, which was called, in those days it was called Cause for Hope, but it became the Lung Cancer Foundation, Roy Castle Lung Cancer Foundation. She phoned me the day after Roy died and said, "Hey Fiona, you're going to be on GMTV on Monday morning." This was Saturday, Monday morning. "You're going to be on GMTV. But don't worry, I'll come and stay the night with you tomorrow night, and I'll drive you to the studio on Monday morning. And so you'll be all right, and I'll hold your hand, so you'll be okay. All right, bye."
It's not exactly what a bereavement counsellor would have recommended.
It wasn't quite what I was expecting. I mean, she didn't say, "Do you feel like it? Are you up to it? Do you want to? Have you got time?"
Goodness.
"No, you're going to be okay, bye." And again, I really panicked.
Yeah.
And I started to pray, "God, you can't expect me to do this." You know, I panic and I say my words wrong and I stammer and I'll make a mess of it. And again, it was one of these wonderful but rare occasions when I heard God speaking.
Mm.
And said, "Rise to the challenge."
Yeah.
And I said, "But God, supposing I make a mess of it?" And the answer was, "If you make a mess of it, you won't be invited again." Do you know, that was the best thing that could have happened to me.
Yeah.
Because I know that I'm going to be answerable to God for everything I have or haven't done in my life. And I don't want him to say, "Where were you when I needed you? I gave you these opportunities, you didn't bother." And I didn't want to get to the end of my life and think, "Where would life have taken me?" Or "What if?" Or "If only."
Yeah.
So it's making the most of, of opportunities, I think.
Yeah. Just one more area I'd like to ask you about, if I may, Fiona, and then I think it'd be nice to give you a break and we'll have
a bit of
a...
Sure, you need that cup of tea or whatever.
Just wanted to ask a little bit. Obviously, the charity work became more and more important. As you have been involved in that, what do you think have been the high points for you, really? Because you carried on with the lung cancer charity.
I did, I'm not so involved these days.
No, okay.
But yes, very much involved.
Yeah.
But I'm also involved with all sorts of other things.
Yeah, go on.
And I think one that I've got, I'm really passionate about is a fairly small Christian charity called Global Care.
Yeah.
And they deal with children at risk in about 17 different countries around the world.
Yeah.
And it was another thing, you know, that God told me, you know, to get on with my life.
Yeah.
And I was invited to go and speak at a service that they were giving for a lot of the people who were involved with the charity. It functions from Coventry. And at the end, I did it, and the founder walked me to the car afterwards and thanked me for what I'd done and said, "Would you become a patron?" And I couldn't think of an excuse, so I said yes. And I thought, well, it's just a line on the, you know, name at the bottom of a bit of writing paper. And said yes, okay.
Yeah.
And that was it. But since then, I've been to so many of these different countries and had opportunities to see the children. It's to deal with children at risk, whether it's from AIDS, whether it's war-torn, you know, persecution and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
So I've been able to go to so many different countries and see these children. Mm. And I can't rest. As long as I've got energy and ability, I want to go on doing what I can to help and support those children. Yeah. Because, you know, when you've actually been with them and seen what they're going through, I can't go to bed at night without thanking God that I've got a warm bed, I've got electricity, I've got central heating, I've got food in the fridge. I've recently been to Lebanon.
Right.
In February I was in Lebanon, and that was an experience.
Quite an eye-opener, I would think.
One of the places that we have is a refugee camp with a school, and we support the school so that they get some education. But every one of those 100 children has a terribly sad story.
Yeah.
You know, they've lost parents, they've lost siblings, they're orphaned or they're living with grandparents. Heartbreaking, but they want education. When I came back to England, I have to say, I wanted every child in England to go to the Lebanon to see what they're going through, yes, and then they'd be grateful for what they have over here.
Yeah, yeah,
because it's
absolutely
heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. So you've done television, you've done charity work. Another area, you've written a few books, haven't you?
Over the years,
how did that come about? How did that...
Well, again, I was coerced into it.
Right.
It was funny because I was asked to write a sort of autobiography when Roy was taken ill.
Yes.
And I said, well, I can't write a book, you know. I'm hopeless, you know. Yeah. So I went to the pastor of our church, the wonderful Jim Graham, who was just such a help to us, and said, this is what I've been asked to do. He said, don't ever turn down the opportunity to write a book.
Yeah.
He said, it might lie dusty on someone's shelf for 100 years, but if one person picks it up and finds help from it, it's been worth writing.
Yeah.
And so that started me off on that score as well.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. And can I mention this? We've got one of your writings. It's a little book called Shine, a 366-day perpetual calendar by Fiona Castle.
It's a calendar. It's just, you know, a thought for the day.
It's lovely. And those are on the... Absolutely.
Yes.
You might perhaps sign one, maybe, if we...
If you insist.
Lovely. So do have a look, folks. We've got some of those on the bookstall. Fiona, I just want to finish with this. You seem to have a lot of energy. You have just kept going and done so many... Where does all this come from?
Well, it's from the Lord.
Right. Yeah.
I've always been an energetic person, I think, having been a dancer and a very determined person.
Yeah.
But God has just given me opportunities that I want to use whilst I have, as I say, whilst I have health to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the bottom line, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
He, as I said to Jesus, you know, I'm giving my life to you. See what you can do with the rest of it. And this is the rest of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Fiona, thank you so much. It's been really fascinating. Really appreciated that. But I think we ought to give you a little bit of a break now. That would be wonderful. Fiona, thank you so much. Can we just thank Fiona for joining us?
Do you want me to go? Friends,